There is, for me, a very interesting date coming up on the calendar quite soon. I look forward to this basic time every year. It's true, though, that the actual date for the event I'm talking about can shift a couple of dates one way or the other, depending on scheduling. But this year it happens to fall on a certain date on the calendar. The date I'm talking about for 2019 is December 25th. Now please don't be shocked. Don't jump up and run screaming out of the hall. The reason I'm looking forward to December 25th this year is because it's the first day of the Foundation Institute continuing education seminars during the upcoming Winter Family Weekend. Aren't you relieved? That's what I look forward to each year, the seminars at the Winter Family Weekend. So you can tell your blood pressure to come down a bit again to normal levels. I don't yet know what the topics will be. They're not listed as of last night, and then I think again this morning, if I remember to double check, on the Winter Family Weekend website. Family, of course, standing for a spiritual family. In this case, accessible through members.cogwa.org. But I know I've enjoyed so many of these presentations in the past years, and I'm looking forward to those 3 days again this year. But I do know one thing. I especially appreciate it when I am in the kind of setting where December the 25th is just the day between December 24th and December 26th. And that's all it is. It's a date on a calendar. In the society in which you and I live, at this time of year, it is unmistakably something else. We have it pounded at us virtually nonstop, especially here in the United States, once Thanksgiving is behind us. Of course, for our Canadian friends, Thanksgiving is behind as well, but it's further behind because it falls on the second Monday in October in Canada, which we in the U.S. look at as Columbus Day. What's ironic for our Canadian friends is that on occasion it is possible for the Day of Atonement and Thanksgiving Day to fall on the same day. That makes it a little interesting. But I want to address something of this contrast for us today. We do get excited, many of us, about the Winter Family Weekend from year to year. It also happens to coincide, on purpose, of course, because so many have time off from work or jobs around the time the world keeps Christmas. It's a good time to schedule something like that because many find it easier to take time away. Christmas is everywhere. And if you can successfully prevent any old Christmas carol from lodging uninvited into your brain cells, congratulations. Because it's just pounded at us all the time. But here's the deal. I want to ask you an important question today, and I want to share with you what my answer would be. Not because my answer is any big deal, but I want to ask you to think about the same issue for you, for yourself. So the sermon title could be Why I Don't Keep Christmas. But if you're taking notes, then you can title it the same way, Why I Don't Keep Christmas. Most of us, I think, are surely getting wished a Merry Christmas pretty frequently these days. And rather than just saying, bah, humbug, I'm sure we have come up with some kind of response. Typically, I just say thank you because I know people mean well, they're being thoughtful, and they're not paying much attention to your response anyway. So you should have your own tried and true methods of dealing with it. I hope you have found out that to give a pretty exhaustive description of the pagan origins of Christmas customs and practices is not the best way to respond. They don't want to hear it, and it's not going to accomplish anything good. Because, you know, there is a way to see that it's really, at this point in time, unimportant if the people around you who wish you those greetings get that or not. The reason is because it's clearly not their time to understand God's plan now. So then, who is it important for? If it's not important for them, Well, I'm looking at them, or in some cases, talking at them, by webcast, I hope. It's important, brethren, for you and for me. Do we know why we do what we do? And just as important, do we know why we don't do what we don't do? That was a technological malfunction. For those of you watching online, I didn't actually do that. You see, I'm not really dealing right this minute with how you can answer somebody who is surprised that you who call yourself a Christian, don't keep Christmas. Because that does surprise people. Sometimes if people want a little more explanation, that may be a way to lead into it. You might say, well, you know, I'm one of those few Christians, using it their way, who doesn't keep Christmas. And if they want to know more, they can ask you. And then you can dump the whole load on them. Still not a good idea. You'll find a way. I know you will. Hopefully one that is wise and not offensive. They still won't really understand. I'm not worried about that right now. And I hope you're not either. What is it that we're going to talk about today, though, if it's not that? What is it that I seem to think you need to know? It's just this, brethren. You and I need to be able to answer these questions whether or not we are asked. For our own sake, we need to know. We need to know, where is it that people went wrong? When did the worship of the wrong kinds of worship start? When did people who may once have a history going back in time begin to worship God in the wrong way? Is there a lesson in it for us? Well, there is, and let's start by going way back in time to see. Turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 11. Deuteronomy 11, the last two verses of the chapter, verses 31 and 32. It says, Moses is talking, you probably know the basic outlook of the book of Deuteronomy, that it's a kind of a repetition of some of the important things from the journeys they'd had so far. And in verse 31, Moses tells the Israelites, for you will cross over the Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God, or the Eternal your God, is giving you, and you will possess it and dwell in it. And you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today. Moses speaks to the leadership of Israel just before his death and just before they were to enter the promised land. At this point in their history, the nation had wandered for 40 years. They were finally on the brink of beginning the conquest of their inheritance. And verse 32 sets a theme that Moses would hammer at this second generation. Be careful to follow the instructions you received from God. Good advice for any peoples, any time, we'd say, and it is. Chapter 12 starts the same way. Verse 1, these are the statutes and the judgments which you shall be careful to observe. There's that phrase again. In the land which the eternal God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. Now, we might make some assumptions at this point. For example, we might assume that the entire time the Israelites wandered in the wilderness, having the tabernacle and the sacrifices, that they naturally worshiped God faithfully. Right? And I see a lot of shaking of heads, and I hear mutterings of, just how dumb do you think we are? No, especially after the painful lesson of their parents losing the privilege of going in to take the land, this second generation would just naturally have been very careful to worship God exactly as he said they should, right? Of course, the answer is wrong. Verse 8, Deuteronomy 12, Moses says this to the second generation. You shall not at all do as we are doing here today, Every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. That could be lifted from the tail end of the book of Judges. In fact, that's just about what it says at the end of the book of Judges. Although it adds the extra thought, because there was no king in Israel, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Barnes Notes says this. I mean, how in this world could this happen? Barnes Notes, interesting, says, Moses points out that heretofore, good word, they had not observed the prescribed order in their worship, because during their migratory life in the wilderness, it had been impossible to do so. During their wanderings, there were doubtless times when the tabernacle was not set up for days together, and when the daily sacrifice, together with many other ordinances, were necessarily omitted. This consideration, Barnes Notes goes on to say, must be carefully borne in mind throughout the entire book of Deuteronomy. It illustrates the necessity for a repetition of very much of the Sinaitic legislation and suggests the reason why some parts are so urgently reiterated and impressed while others are left unnoticed. Moses now warns the people that as they were about to quit their unsettled mode of life, God's purpose of choosing for himself a place to set his name there would be executed. And I think that's pretty well stated. Let's continue here in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and pick up on Moses' warnings and instructions again. And keep in mind that theme that Barnes Notes said of a place to set his name. Keep going here in chapter 12, verse 9. For as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Eternal your God is giving you. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place which the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I commanded you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, all your choice offerings which you vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no part, no portion nor inheritance with you. Take heed to yourself, that you do not offer your burnt offerings in just every place that you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses, etc., etc., etc. Quite a focus, quite a stress. They've been living a migratory way of life, as Barnes put it, and now as they were about ready to leave their unsettled way of life and exchange it for a settled way of life in the promised land, things were going to change in their patterns of living. And they were told to remember to do everything God had commanded them. And there's quite a stress if you look at verses 5, 11, 14. It mentions it again. We just read that part. Verse 18, again in verse 21, and once more in verse 26. It uses the phrase, the place, the place, the place. And the word there, referring to the place, is also mentioned in some of those verses as well. And the phrase before the eternal is mentioned in verse 7, verse 12, two times in verse 18. It keeps cropping up as well. So when you add it all up, this theme of before the Lord or before the eternal and the place or the place which he shall choose to set or put his name shows up in 9 verses out of the 32 in this chapter. It's quite a chunk, almost a third. What would this do for the nation of Israel? Again, keep in mind they'd been wandering for 40 years. An entire generation had died in the wilderness. Well, a single centralized place of worship was intended to purify and unify Israel in its worship of God. They would be less inclined to look around at other nations who had altars and high places and all kinds of stuff going on just about every which place you could think of. They would all look to the same place, somewhere that God would designate, as it says, within your tribes, somewhere unique in the entire world. The tabernacle, first, would be there, wherever there was. Later, of course, it would be a temple. God's presence would be understood to be there. Now you're probably thinking Jerusalem, right? Well, wrong, at least initially. Very briefly, and only in a temporary manner, it was in Gilgal until the land was subdued. Then it was sort of permanently temporary, because it was a tent after all, in Shiloh, in the territory of Ephraim. You can look up Joshua chapter 18 and see how that's described. And it was in Shiloh for a long time. Well, what about Jerusalem, you might wonder? Good question. It would be almost 500 years before a temple was built in Jerusalem during the reign of King Solomon. That's a long time. 500 years. How much do you or I know about what happened in the year 1519? Not a whole lot. That, of course, when it happened, the building of the temple, was a momentous occasion in Israel. We can see references to it in 2 Chronicles. In 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verse 4, he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel." This is Solomon speaking. "Who has fulfilled with his hands what he spoke with his mouth to my father David, saying," verse 5 now, 2 Chronicles 6, 5, "since the day that I brought my people out of the land of Egypt, I have chosen no city from any tribe of Israel in which to build a house, that my name might be there. Nor did I choose any man to be a ruler over my people Israel. Yet I have chosen Jerusalem to build this house." Now, before it was just a tent in Gilgal and then Shiloh. "I have chosen Jerusalem, that my name may be there, and I have chosen David to be over my people Israel." And Solomon goes on to explain how it was in his father David's heart to build the temple. Brief explanation that that wouldn't happen. God had said, "No, I want your son to do it." Read God's words to his people back then, relayed in chapter 7. Beginning in verse 12, it was God's answer to Solomon's prayer to him. 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 12, it says, "Then the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said to him, 'I have heard your prayer, and I have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice.'" So here we begin to see all those prophecies we were reading about in Deuteronomy starting to come to pass. God says, "I have chosen this place. When I shut up heaven and there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. For now I have chosen and sanctified," meaning set apart, "this house, that my name may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually." My heart, interesting phrase. I think we can begin to see how it was that the people of the tribe of Judah especially began to develop a very emotional connection to the temple itself. And you see remnants of that even today when you visit Israel, as we stood at the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall, and observed this past June. This was the way in which God sanctified, or set apart for a holy use, the temple that Solomon had built. From that point on in their history, the temple became extremely important to Israel. Later, as we know, the northern tribes seceded from the house of David, and only Judah, with remnants of Benjamin and Levi, continued to regard Jerusalem with the temple as the capital and the focal point of the nation. But even in the wake of that separation, remember what happened. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 12. Jeroboam, the king of Israel, first king of the nation of Israel after the split, was composed now basically of what we call the northern 10 tribes. He knew what kind of a pull, an emotional pull, the temple would have on the people. And he was afraid they would want to return to Jerusalem to worship, and that might lead to their reuniting under Solomon's son Rehoboam, and he had no illusions about what would happen to him in that case. 1 Kings 12 and verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, and he dwelt there. He also went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me, and they'll go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So the king asked advice, and he made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." Two calves. Boy, that harkens back to Exodus, doesn't it? And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Once again, this past trip that we made in June, we saw the remnants of the worship site in Dan. The foundation of the altar is still there. Still there. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places, and he made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. At Bethel, he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart, and he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. You notice what he did? He devised and established an alternate way to worship God. You see, I don't keep Christmas, some might say, because it's the birthday of Jesus. I know that it couldn't have been his birthday, but I do it to honor him. Is that acceptable to God? You know, he actually drew on the religion of the Egyptians. That was the golden calf figure. And the Canaanites, the shrines on the high places. And he moved the timing of a great festival. Of course, the 15th day of the 7th month, as we all well know, is the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles. So he postponed it a month to the 15th day of the 8th month. You see, even astronomically, it would look familiar to them. There would be a full moon, just like it would be when you began the Feast of Tabernacles. Interestingly enough, just like it is when you begin the Days of Unleavened Bread, too. Strange. Calves to worship were set up, northern and southern boundaries. No matter which way you went to the extremities of the nation, you could find a golden calf to worship there. I don't know if the one in the south was intended to make them think twice about journeying south. Of course, the timing was different, off by a month. What happened to these northern tribes? Well, the separation from the kingdom of Judah became permanent. The corruption was lasting, and they were severed from God because they no longer worshiped in a way that even came close to what he had given them. Please remember that. They claimed they were worshiping some kind of God, Maybe they even said and deluded themselves in their minds that this just, we know that's not God, but it reminds us of God. Who knows? They forsook the place of worship which God had established in Jerusalem, and they lost their identity. They no longer knew who they were. For about 250 years, Judah remained more or less faithful. That is, at least they acknowledged the patterns God had given them. But in the reign of the wicked king Manasseh, they almost entirely forsook God's directions. Turn to 2 Kings chapter 21. Second Kings 21 and verse 1. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah. He did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. He rebuilt the high places Hezekiah his father had destroyed. He raised up altars for Baal or Baal. He made a wooden image as Ahab the king of Israel had done. He worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He built altars in the house of the Eternal, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem I will put my name." And he built altars for the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Eternal. Also, he made his son pass through the fire, practicing soothsaying. He used witchcraft. He consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Lord had said to David and Solomon his son, "In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever." Can you imagine what an offensive thing that was to God? It talks about all the instructions, all that I have commanded them, verse 8, according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them, but they paid no attention. And Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. It goes on and on and on. Verse 16 sums it up. Well, verse 12, God begins to prophesy what will happen. It didn't happen immediately. It was a few more generations in the sense that it was a few more kings who reigned, including one more righteous one, Josiah. But it says in verse 12, "Therefore, thus says the Lord God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such calamity upon Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle. I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. So I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies, and they shall become victims of plunder to all their enemies. Because they have done evil in my sight, and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day." Look at the pattern. "Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another, besides his sin by which he made Judah sin in doing evil in the sight of the Eternal." This was just about more than God could take. Like I said, even then, in his mercy, he did not totally withdraw from the temple. Sometimes the priests were faithful, sometimes they were not. There was still one more righteous king, Josiah. Even in Christ's day, despite the spiritual corruption of the priests, Jesus Christ still called the temple, by now the second temple that had been begun in Ezra and Nehemiah's day with major renovations by Herod. He called it my Father's house, John 2 and verse 16. But there is another interesting scripture in the Gospel of John which begins to move us to our own time now. It's in John chapter 4. John 4. Jesus Christ, as I'm sure you remember, strikes up a conversation here with a Samaritan woman at the well. He tells her so much about her own circumstance in life that she's convinced he's a prophet, verse 19. And in verse 20, the woman says something very important to him. Now, remember that the Samaritans were actually Gentiles. They were not really of the house of Israel, the northern tribes, even though the capital had been Samaria. The Assyrians, when they conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, actually brought in displaced peoples from other areas that they'd conquered and planted them there. That's in 2 Kings 17. You can read about it there. So they weren't Israelites. So she says, as if she was descended from an Israelite, she says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. And yet you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." Well, yes, that's what they said, because the temple was there. But you notice, we're still talking about a place. She says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain." And you can actually go back to Deuteronomy. We didn't read it, but right where we were in Deuteronomy 11, there was talk about having the equivalent of a blessing on Mount Gerizim and a curse on Mount Ebal, and the two sides were to sort of communicate and talk with each other. This is what you will receive if God blesses you. This is what you receive if you're cursed. It was on a mountain as they were about to enter the promised land. So she says that. She focuses on that. You Jews say it's in Jerusalem. Christ had news for her. Verse 21. "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father." He says, wait a minute, you missed the whole point. It isn't about a place. That place was just designed to make them focus on worshiping the true God. Don't go anywhere else. Come here so you can see that you ought to worship me. Look at verse 24. "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." Doesn't that last verse just restate what Moses kept telling the Israelites, the second generation back in Deuteronomy 12? He said, be careful to remember all of the statutes and the laws that my God has given you. Be careful to keep exactly what he told you to do. Don't vary from it. Don't add to it. Don't subtract from it. Don't think you have a better, more refined view of true worship. Just do what God said you're supposed to do. That was the most important thing about following God's instructions, in spirit and in truth. That's what's important to God. That, brethren, is why we do what we do and why we don't do the things we don't do and why we do nothing else besides what God told us. That's what I want to emphasize today. We could have a long description of where all the customs of Christmas came from. But you can look that up. We don't even have to go to the library and get out the Encyclopedia Britannica anymore. You can Google it. That is now a verb in the English language. And you can find all kinds of information about where it all comes from. That's not unknown to a fairly significant portion of the population. And yet, they continue. That's why we need to know the answers to these questions, even if nobody ever asks us. The question is, do you know it? Do I know it? Do we know why we do what we do? where does Christmas fit with all that? Well, it doesn't, because it's not in spirit and in truth. When people say, well, I know Christ wasn't really born then, but we do it to honor him, or we do it for the children. Ask, is it in spirit and in truth? As they lie to their children about flying reindeer and a fat man in a red suit squeezing down the chimney without getting so much as a speck of soot on his suit, and eating cookies and milk in every house in the whole world, you would have an enormous belly ache. You'd have an enormous belly, let alone the ache. But that's what goes on. And what about that place that had been so important back in the times of the Israelites? Well, when it came down to it, God built his church in the New Testament era, and he founded it on the day of Pentecost in the year AD 31 by the giving of the Holy Spirit. Do you know what else was going on in Jerusalem as the church began on the day of Pentecost in AD 31? The temple was still there. The temple was still functioning. In fact, we find in the gospel, in the book of Acts, not gospel, but the book of Acts in chapter 6 and verse 7, it says, then the word of God spread, and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests were obedient to the faith. There were a number of members of the headquarters church in Jerusalem. If you were to say, what do you do? I'm a Levitical priest. Really? Yeah. I serve in the ninth, you know, the ninth course of whoever ninth course was. Eighth course was Abijah, because that was Zacharias, the father of John. There were a number of priests in the church, and it was not wrong for them to continue to serve in the priesthood, which had been established by God to the descendants of Aaron and the tribe of Levi, and so it was not a problem. But a lot of other things had gone wrong all around them. One entire book of the New Testament would gently help the church, the early church, to see that the physical place was no longer what God was looking at. It's the book of Hebrews. We spent a little bit of time there last week in the sermon, as you recall. But in Hebrews chapter 8, Hebrews 8 and verse 1. Now this is the main point of the things we're saying. We have such a high priest. This follows chapter 7, which spends a great deal of time talking about the priesthood of Melchizedek, who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the true sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected, and not man. See the contrast? Despite the grandeur of the tabernacle and the even greater grandeur of Solomon's temple, they were built by human beings. The Israelites didn't wake up one morning in the desert and poof, the tabernacle was right there. The people of Jerusalem didn't wake up during the reign of Solomon and, where did that building come from last night? It was built by human beings. It didn't just appear. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that this one also have something to offer. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, that is the Levitical, or the Levirate law, it's sometimes called, that who is in the priesthood, the sons of Levi and the family of Aaron, the according to the law, who serve the copy and the shadow of the heavenly things. I recall that I stressed that last week, talking about Melchizedek. As Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. So much more to be explained. How hard that must have been for some to understand. What about those who were actually still serving as Levitical priests in the church? And there would have been a few. But God's meaning is clear. You go to chapter 9 and verse 11. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle not made with hands. Once again, he stresses that. That is, not of this creation. Not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? For this reason, he's the mediator of the new covenant. Moses was the mediator, or the go-between, of the old covenant. He spoke to the people. They asked him. They pleaded with him. They said, don't let God speak to us again. We're going to die. You go talk to him. If anybody's going to be, you know, be struck dead, let it be you, not us. Seems to be implied. He's the mediator of the new covenant by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions under the first one, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. Promises were greater. The same instruction, obey what God says to do. You look at chapter 12 of Hebrews. Chapter 12 and verse 18, you have not come to the mountain that may be touched and that burned with fire. So if we're worshiping God, where is it we go to worship? And to blackness and darkness and tempest and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the word would not be spoken to them anymore. Drop down to verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. Do you ever think about, as you pray, where you are? And to whom you are addressing? And whom you are addressing? To whom you are speaking? To the general assembly and church of the firstborn, registered in heaven. They're not there looking down on you. They're dead and buried. But, you know, those who have died. But God has, as it says, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect. The spirit and man component is there with God somehow, somewhere. I'm not sure how he files it or stores it. I doubt if there's, like, you know, filing cabinets. It's probably not a Dewey Decimal System or anything. Even if there are people named Dewey who've died and been sealed for the first resurrection. Sorry, bad joke. To Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. Think about where you are when you pray. See that you don't refuse him who speaks. For if they didn't escape who refused him who spoke on earth, how much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I shake not just the earth but heaven. Yet once more indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken. Eventually, this physical planet will not look like this anymore. 2 Peter 3 talks about that. As of things that are made, that the things which cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, a proper awe, and a willingness to stick closely to what he said. And then just the passing thought he adds, for our God is a consuming fire. That's one aspect of God. How important are these things, brethren? Hebrews 12, I think, makes it rather abundantly clear. Has God prepared a place, literally, physically, for his people? Well, we just read the heavenly Jerusalem. The heavenly Jerusalem. In chapter 11 and verse 16 in the faith chapter, it talks about a heavenly city. It talks about we seek another country. The word country is in italics. I find that interesting in chapter 11 when it talks about it. Refers to homeland, verse 14 of Hebrews 11. Those who say these things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. It talks about if they had called to mind that country, is in italics, perhaps it could be place. That is, now they desire 16, a better, that is a heavenly. Again, the word country is used, but it's in italics. I wonder if we couldn't put place there, because we kept reading place everywhere through Deuteronomy and through some of the other passages, Second Chronicles, and so on. And it lists the faithful and how they've looked to God. Here we have, chapter 13 and verse 14 of Hebrews says, for here we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. That's pretty clear. Hebrews 13, verse 14. Here we have no continuing city. We seek the one to come. We're looking forward to something so much greater. The place, as important as it once was only a means to an end. The key part of Moses' instruction to Israel was not so much to set apart a place of worship as it was to show them that they were to be set apart as God's people by their worship of Him. Remember what it said even back in Leviticus 19? God says, be holy, for I, your God, am holy. That's what he wanted. That's what he was after. He wasn't after making them focus on a piece of real estate. But by using that as a tool, it was to help them see God's presence is here. God lives here. The Holy of Holies is here. At Christ's death, the veil of the temple was torn in two. Access was given to where God lives. But he wasn't in the temple. Where is he? He's in the third heaven. His son is at his right hand, awaiting his father's instruction to come back. Where to go to him there? That's why I say, chapter 12 of Hebrews, do you think about where you are when you pray? Now, we can go back to Deuteronomy 12. Because we ought to be clear on what God wants of His people now and always. Careful obedience. That's really why, brethren, you don't keep Christmas. Or at least it should be. That's why I don't keep Christmas. Because it's not what God says to do. I'm reminded often of the words of the Roman centurion in the days of Christ. His simple statement, I am a man under authority. There is so much encapsulated in that statement. I am a man under authority. We are all human beings, men and women, under authority. Primarily of Jesus Christ. And that's the most important part of all. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Verse 2. You shall utterly destroy all the places, interesting, where the nations which you shall dispossess served their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills under every green tree. You shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Eternal your God with such things. Did we see what was important? Does he say you should never set foot on such place again? No, he says destroy all evidence of what was done at those places. You will not worship me that way. They were not to incorporate the customs of the people of the land into their worship of God. But brethren, that is exactly where the customs of Christmas have come from. The customs of the pagan, which from the Latin words means rural or from the country. Peoples of the land of the Roman Empire back in the 3rd and 4th centuries. You remember how I said earlier, if you are able to not have the words of some Christmas carol lodge in your brain, congratulations. There is one. It's called the First Noel. And I'm sorry if it now pops into your mind. And every time I hear it, I go... The First Noel was in the 4th century. Because they didn't keep it during the 1st century when Christ was alive and then died and went to God in heaven. You know, it's just... And it doesn't do any good to get frustrated. Calm. That's exactly where it's all come from. That is what the established church of the day, the Roman Catholic Church, did back then. They wanted to make it easier for the people of the country, pagans, that is Latin word, rural, from the countryside, to worship the Christian God. So they blended all these various customs together. So if they worshiped the Son, as many of them did, they were told about the Son of God. If they included a day for the worship of the dead in their customs, they were told, fine, you can keep that day, but instead of your customs that you have, which are so dark and awful, think about the saints in heaven and the sinners in hell and call it All Saints Day, November 1st. And the evening before it, of course, became All Hallows Eve on October 31st. Does that sound familiar at all? Hallows Eve, or Hallows Evening, or Halloween. The result? The Catholic Church spread its view of Christianity throughout Europe at the time into the British Isles until Henry VIII rebelled because he wanted to follow and obey God. No, he wanted to have 6 wives, one after the other, and the Pope said he couldn't. So that's how Britain rejected the authority of the Pope and the Catholic Church. Mexico, Latin America. The Protestants borrowed heavily from the same customs and spread theme and variations to North America, Australia, and New Zealand, South Africa, etc., etc., etc. But from the beginning, Deuteronomy 12, God said his true people must have nothing to do with mixing pagan customs with his instructions. Verses 29 to 32 of Deuteronomy 12. When the eternal your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you're not ensnared to follow them. Which is why he told them in verses 2, 3, and 4, destroy all those places of that kind of worship. Tear it down, burn the images, get rid of it all. Do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I'll do likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. And even in their case, every abomination which he hates they've done to their gods, they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. The truth itself would identify them and set them apart. What did Jesus Christ pray in his final prayer to his Father? John 17, 17. Sanctify them by your word. Your word is truth. Sanctify them. Set them apart. Make them different. Make them special and unique by your truth being present in their lives. John 17, 17. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. Of course, we could add 2 Corinthians 6, where we're told to come out from among them and be separate and so on. Why then do I not keep Christmas? And if you're taking notes, you can write in your notes if you like. Why do I not keep Christmas? Why am I not all that concerned about whether we can convince people that we are right and they are wrong? Because that's not important. They're going to continue to do whatever they want to do, no matter what you say to them. And the reasons we would give them, to try to simplify it a bit, are not really the core of why we don't keep Christmas. Yes, it's true, the customs came from paganism. That's only like a second step of why we don't keep it. They keep it even if they know it can't be true. And we don't keep it because it isn't true. Unless or until God opens a mind to see why truth makes a difference, people cannot see. For us, God's truth is reason enough. In effect, the world, along with Pilate, says, "What is truth?" It isn't because Christmas is too commercialized. It isn't because it's politically correct, or because we must value all religions and customs equally. We follow, to the best of our ability, the same way of life God originally revealed to Israel through Moses, the same way that Jesus Christ expanded to the spirit of the law as he taught his disciples, the same way we look for a new city, a new place. We desire most of all to worship him in spirit and in truth. Then, when we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 29 and 30 and 31 and 32, they make sense. Are we this careful? It's as good time as any, good a time as any right now to be sure of that fact and long for the day when everyone will understand God's beautiful plan. Oh, and by the way, did I mention that it's only 115 days till Passover?